The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Last week, the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, called on social media companies to shut down accounts spreading misinformation about vaccines. But why do we fall for these false claims in the first place, and how can we spot them? Well, my next guest has written a book to help us improve our critical thinking skills to stop us falling into the trap of flawed logic. It's called Irrational Ape, subtitled Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. David Robert Grimes is with me. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, conspiracy theories, they are everywhere.
They are. They are certainly ubiquitous.
And it's one of your areas of interest, in addition to being a pure scientist.
It's unfortunate I dabble in academically. I'm more fascinated by why people believe these kind of narratives and why people construct these incredibly elaborate stories to explain events. And it turns out that whether you're talking about vaccination policy, like Simon Harris referred to the other day, or whether you're trying to talk about 9/11, that there's similar kind of flaws in logic that people rely on to build these stories in the first instance.
Now, talking about anti-vax campaigners, you point out that this is not something new. This is not only going back to Wakefield. It goes back much further than that.
Absolutely. I mean, there's sermons recorded from the 1700s. It was originally a religious opposition to vaccination because it was the idea that you were, you know, suddenly you were taking God's choice out of it. And this was an era where children died, you know, very often in infancy from infectious diseases that are now preventable. So when that suddenly changed, there was people that had an ideological opposition to that. And that has always been bubbling in the background up to now. What has changed now massively, I mean, we all go back to the Wakefield era, and often people think that's the first modern anti-vaccine kind of scare. In some ways it was, but now what's really changed everything is social media. Because now, instead of having to get journalists on board and you know, feed misinformation to the right people, I can simply go on Facebook and set up a meme or go on Twitter and I can frighten people. And that fear, it causes a vaccine hesitancy. So most of the parents that don't vaccinate their children, they're not necessarily anti-vaccine. The anti-vaccine component are a very small minority.
They just worry about doing their children harm.
Absolutely. And if they're frightened and they don't know what to believe, and they hear, and if you see the kind of memes that they share around, the biggest single predictor of whether something is shared online or not is whether it induces an emotional resonance. So if I put something up there that tells you your children might die or this is very, very dangerous, and you don't see the benefits as clearly because they seem abstract or like intangible to you.
Not getting measles is an abstract kind of a thing.
Absolutely. A negative is an abstract,
you know,
right?
So dying of the vaccine
is terrifying.
Is terrifying, and even though it's irrational.
Yeah, and they will always amp that up. And unfortunately, there's a lot of research that kind of indicates to us we're not great at differentiating the reputable from the reprehensible. So we often fall into these kind of traps. And social media has definitely amplified that, but it's always been something that we can fall for.
Now, we know that, say, for example, in terrorist movements, they often have isolated cells so that nobody knows everything, and therefore they can't dish the dirt on the people if they're caught and tortured and all the rest of it. How isolated are all of these different anti-vaxxers, or are they all part of one great conspiracy?
Well, oddly enough, belief in one conspiracy, so belief in conspiracy tends not to be an isolated event. If you believe in one conspiracy, you're far more likely to take other ones on. And anti-vaccination, to believe in that, you have to kind of believe the medical establishments are lying to you. So you already are a conspiracy theorist to some extent. The philosopher W.V. Quine said that we have a web of belief. So all of our ideas are actually intertangled with each other. And when you manipulate one belief, so if I force myself to believe that, you know, that vaccination is bad, I also have to believe that the medical establishment and the scientific establishment are lying to me. And I become far more likely to believe other conspiracy theories. So what's interesting is you rarely get conspiracy theories in isolation. The biggest thing, to answer your other question, is that it's not necessarily these views don't have to be internally consistent. In fact, there's a classic study, which I quote in the book and I absolutely love, is ones that people who were conspiratorially minded were asked, were told that either Princess Diana had been murdered by the Queen or Princess Diana had faked her own death. And what was absolutely fascinating is people that were the most heavily involved in conspiratorial kind of movements would believe both of these narratives simultaneously, like Schrodinger's, you know, Princess Diana. And that shows to, that kind of reveals information that really it's about having superior knowledge or an illusion of it that really matters.
Now, talk about the Twin Towers. And they could not have collapsed under their own weight because steel is strong and steel would have to melt. And those temperatures were not there to allow the steel to melt. So how do they collapse except that the authorities had planted bombs to bring them down.
So what's fantastic is the best myths have a little grain of truth in the middle, but totally morphed into something it shouldn't be. So it's absolutely true, as the conspiracy theorists say, that jet fuel can't melt steel beams, but it doesn't have to. They lose their tensile strength in the high temperatures.
Everyone knows that the blacksmith will soften the horseshoe so that he can bend it. He couldn't bend it at room temperature.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't melt,
absolutely,
but it can be bent.
And at the temperatures inside the Twin Towers, that steel was about 10% of its tensile strength. So pretty much every floor collapsed. And you see it in the videos, progressively collapsing, pancaking, down, down, and down. Controlled demolitions, incidentally, are taken from the ground up. If you've ever seen a building being demolished, they don't go the other way around for good reason. But it's always a little grain of truth, misunderstood and warped, that people cling on to. But again, just to already support, and this is a thing called confirmation bias. If you're already inclined to believe that, say, 9/11 was an inside job, well, then you're far more likely to take that bit of information about steel beams and ignore the other part that tells you, well, actually, you've misunderstood that information.
But also, the conspiracy theorists who believe it was an inside job, they would come from the point of view, perhaps, that the United States is so all-powerful that no ragbag of Middle Eastern terrorists could do this to the mighty nation. Therefore, it had to be the enemy within.
Well, oddly enough, that's another motivator for conspiracy theory. So there's a thing called aversion to randomness. We don't like the idea that things like that can happen. We prefer, even if it's a negative story, we prefer to believe that things are structured. There's a reason that this isn't just a stochastic mess. So oddly enough, in a dark way, conspiracy theories can be oddly reassuring that this must have been preordained.
It couldn't happen to me. But then if you take something like a road accident, a traffic accident where someone, a child is out playing and is run down by a car. I mean, that is truly a random thing. And there is no way you can attach a logic to it and say that child was hurt because of... Or maybe they do. Maybe they say...
There are some people that do. I mean, certainly in vaccination and in the anti-vaccine movement, you see children who die, say, with unsafe sleeping practices. And often that is then explained away as, oh, it must have been the vaccine. And you kind of see the rationale for that. People don't want to think they might have been responsible or contributed towards that, you know, that child's early demise. And it's probably easier to believe that some external agent was responsible for it. So to an extent it happens, but I mean, we don't like random events. We're just not good at them.
People who are pioneering in scientific research often have their doubters from the establishment of the time. Galileo would be an example. Darwin would be an example.
Well, to an extent. But remember, Galileo was widely supported by the nascent scientific community of the time.
But the church, of course.
Well, he may actually, the oddly enough, the Cardinal Barberini, I talk about it a little bit in the book, the guy that originally was his persecutor in the end, was originally his friend. That's why he felt brave enough to make these statements. And what the actual cardinal asked him to do, said, I don't mind you writing about this, but put the arguments for a geostationary Earth into the book as well. Which Galileo did, but he put those words, the Pope's words exactly, into the mouth of a character who was obviously an idiot. So it actually became a real barbed insult. So he had offended the Pope as well. That's an interesting one. Darwin himself converted a lot of people very early on because he had just so much evidence. Like he presented this lovely theory and then he'd spent years and years gathering up evidence for it. So... scientific ideas do change, and you can talk about paradigm shifts, and we can talk about Kuhn, or we can talk about Popper, but I think the bigger thing is the narratives we build around them evolve as well.
And the idea, you see, when you have that confluence of religion and science, and where the two, I mean, the creationists, for example, are still out there, and still... it seems, in American classrooms.
Absolutely. Or they're certainly trying to get their way in there. And it's interesting because they're, as I always say to people, you can look at different ways of religion and science actually being compatible in some versions, as the non-overlapping magisteria version of Stephen Jay Gould. And I would often say, if people ask me a religious question, that I'm a scientist, I have no, I can't answer that. So if you believe in evolution, it's not, and you believe in God, I don't think they're incompatible. You can say, well, that's the mechanism that God put in place to make everything happen. So biblical literalism is a weird one, because it's literally this book has to be taken at face value, even though the early church would have known it was allegorical. And it's a weird, very American take on taking things literally, I think.
Some of the comments coming in. Studying history in school should be compulsory in the era of fake news. When you study it properly, you learn that the idea that humanity's direction is planned by some secret global cabal is just ridiculous. All conspiracies ignore the realities of human error and the chaos of daily life. Another one, please explain to my friend Tony better than I can that the world is not flat. Another one says, conspiracy theory, the idea of it, was invented by the CIA to help cover up JFK's murder.
Of course, that is a conspiracy theory. Oddly enough, there's a beautiful bit of history. I always find people that say things like that are kind of useful idiots, right? So many, many years ago during the Cold War, when we didn't have social media, there was a whole, and I talk a little bit about it in the book, there was a Russian unit, and they still exist to this day, who were very good at sending out disinformation to undermine their allies. And they realized in the 60s that you could, say, give money to a conspiracy tinge group in America who would go out and put out these kind of narratives and would undermine themselves. So the irony is, some of these groups that perpetuated narratives like JFK was assassinated by the CIA, or that fluoride is turning us all into mindless robots, some of that money did actually come from the Russian Secret Service to go and undermine American politics. It's fascinating.
Then, you have digital fifth columns now, we saw the hacking of the US election. And this, I think, it's probably accepted by everybody except Donald Trump that it did happen.
Absolutely. I mean, the evidence is fairly incontrovertible. And you can see why, from a geopolitical standpoint, that if you can make your opponent, so one of the things about conspiracy theories that I find really fascinating is that they're actually societally damaging. They're not harmless, because actually they cause us to distrust our sources of information. And there's nothing wrong with asking questions. We should. I mean, I'm very strong on that. But we should ask questions in an objective way and not just assume this kind of cynicism where, you know, I disbelieve everything, because that's the apathy we can kind of walk into. And that's exactly why conspiracy theories are so damaging. They induce an apathy. I don't believe anything. Everything's nonsense. Well, some things aren't nonsense. And not everything is Nietzschean and subjective. And that's an issue.
One of the texters wants to know, would Robert ever believe any conspiracy theory that might be true?
I assume they mean me. I'm David Roberts. David, that's okay. David. That's all right. I will believe anything you give me the evidence to believe. And that's what I argue very strongly. No matter how outlandish something is, if you show someone enough evidence to show it, right, and also you have to weigh the totality of evidence. You don't just show people one side and say, you know, that's the evidence. You have to look at everything. So would I believe something? I mean, arguably I believe that Russian disinformation happened during the elections. That could be construed as conspiratorial, but there's a lot of evidence for it. So I'm happy to believe that.
And again, did Russia hack Brexit? We don't know.
We have some evidence indicating that way. Again, it would make sense to do it and there is historical precedent for it, by the way. I do talk about it a lot. This has been going on for years, this game of trying to, you know, turn someone's media against them. This is, you know, a basic real politic kind of thing that goes on. So what I would say is, believe anything that there is enough evidence to believe, but that evidence has to be viewed in totality. You can't just cherry pick the bits you want to.
Okay, so how do you torpedo fake news and misinformation? The subtitle of your book is about critical thinking. I mean, is it that pretty soon, I suspect that, for example, a few bad encounters on Tinder might lead people to believe that everything you see on the internet is not always as it appears. Indeed, people's profiles and all the rest of it can lie all the time. So you become slightly cynical about all of that and therefore approach it more critically?
I would say that we should aim to be skeptical rather than cynical. So cynical is the default of just, oh, you know, I'm everything is nonsense. And that's not actually true. What we do need to do, and it's imperative we do this quickly, is we need to learn what questions we should be asking and what we should construe as evidence and what we should not. So basically, like, we have to take the same schema that maybe a scientist would use to challenge a question and go, why do I believe this? Should I believe that or should I believe this? And there are methods, which I talk about at some length, that we can do that with. And it's never been more critical that we do it, because now we are absolutely, the same tool that allows us access to the world's repository of information has also allowed falsehood to perpetuate unchecked. And we are overwhelmed by it. So being able to separate these things out and work out, okay, what should I be asking? And I would say the questions, it's the method. What method do I go through for coming to an answer that will get me in the least amount of trouble and get me the most objectively true answer I can find
from
this?
But the problem that's observable, you know, you see kids posting their life on social media, and it's clearly not their real life. It's,
sure,
you know, showing every meal they've had and every enjoyable experience they've had, or the, you know, they use filters on their photograph, and it's clearly not real. And yet the other kids looking at this feel envious of something that in their bones they know is simply not true.
It's an aspirational Instagram influencer kind of thing. And that's why I spent a lot of the time talking about human psychology, because actually that's really, it turns out I didn't really initially think that I had to write about that at all. And as I did the research for the book, it became really important that this is actually what kind of makes us believe something or not. So being able to wonder, why do I envy that when I know it's not true? And knowing a little bit about what we're likely to react to helps us away from poor decisions and poor conclusions. But we have to learn this.
It's not the tragedy, I suppose, in this age of celebrity, that it can take the death of a celebrity from a condition or the recovery of a celebrity from breast cancer, or a Kylie Minogue or something like that, to change people's minds.
So, and it's an odd one. There's two examples I can spring to mind. Obviously, there's Jade Goody, who, when she died of cervical cancer in 2007, smear test requests went up massively. They hit a huge high. The problem is that's often very short-lived, because only a few years later they're at a 19-year low. So there's a half-life of those kind of, it's in the public mind, because we have a thing, we're slaves to the availability heuristic. If information is readily available and it's in our mind, oh, I heard about that last week, or I saw that on the news, we weigh that and we afford that far more importance and far more criticality than we normally would. And we have to be aware that we are a little bit lazy in that. If it's available information to us, it's easy to find. This, incidentally, is why, say, anti-vaccine memes can influence new parents so much, because they go, what do I know about this vaccine? Well, I saw all these scary things on Facebook. That's what's available to them. So, again, celebrity is a great example of that. What's available to us?
Well, it's a fantastic book. It's called The Irrational Ape. It's available in hardback for around €15 in every bookshop in the country, I hope. And its author, David Robert Grimes, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.